Hello, KPTZ listeners. My name is Shelley Levins, and I'm the Executive Director of the Jefferson County Historical Society. Welcome to Episode 3 of our ongoing program series this spring, The Port Townsend Paper Mill, Past, Present, and Future. I'd like to start off tonight with a land acknowledgement. We acknowledge that here at the museum in Port Townsend, we are on the ancestral homelands of the Sklallam peoples, and throughout broader Jefferson County are on the traditional lands of many different tribes of the Olympic Peninsula. Native peoples have lived on and stewarded these lands since time immemorial and continue to do so today. This series is being conducted in partnership with the City of Port Townsend, Port Townsend Public Library, the Port Townsend Paper Mill, KPTZ 91.9, and Swan School. Thanks so much to all of our partners. A special thanks as well to local historian and writer Pam Kleiss, who interviewed all the narrators for our paper mill oral histories with the help of Ann Welch as well. The biggest thanks goes to all the narrators themselves, who shared their stories with us for the archival record from which we were able to select for this program. The series, including our program this hour, in their own words, Mill Workers Past and Present, is all about the history and product of the mill, brown craft paper. I hope you've been able to attend the last two programs in the series. The first, an overview of the mill's history of operations, and the second, on the water system. If you missed either of them, I encourage you to visit our website, where you'll find the recordings. This program is also being recorded, and the recording will be available for you to listen on the KPTZ archive. We'll link to it on our mill programs page as well. Just go to jchsmuseum.org to find all the links. Still coming in April and May, we will feature three art exhibitions related to the paper mill. It was too irresistible not to bring artists into the mix when there was so much paper available. One will be of Swan School student work in downtown Port Townsend, as well as exhibits at the museum and library with artists Karen Rudd and Dana Spires, all featuring artworks made using the mill's brown craft paper. Throughout this program series, families are able to check out papermaking kits and follow your nose bingo smell games at the Port Townsend Public Library. We hope you'll continue to engage with the programs as they wrap up this spring. As you'll hear in detail tonight, the mill has a nearly 100-year prominent presence to life in Port Townsend and Jefferson County, and we know that lots of newcomers and longtime residents alike are curious to learn more about what the mill is all about. As a newcomer to Port Townsend myself, here just 3 years now, I've discovered that one of the most interesting things about having a factory in our town is that reminder that the things we enjoy as consumers do not just magically appear, they are made. They're made in factories all over the world, and they're made right here in our community. The presence of the mill in our community since 1928 gives us a direct linkage to learn about many themes that are relevant to today's conversations, and many of which will be explored by our narrators tonight, including manufacturing processes, innovation, and the industrial and labor history of this area, personal or family history within a small rural community, how the economy and jobs change who lives here through time, natural resource use in the Pacific Northwest, including timber, water, and the fisheries, and the concept of recycling. Did you know that 1/3 of all cardboard in Washington State is recycled right here and turned into this incredibly simple recycled brown craft paper? Yep, I believe that the mill can play a role in this type of place-based learning. I believe that when we look to our local industries, it allows people of all ages an opportunity to ask questions about what and who the spaces we create and cultivate include and exclude, and how we know what we know about the past. With all of that in mind, tonight I've curated a selection of four people who will share their oral histories with us and have worked at the mill through the years. We've recorded many more mill stories than that, and we hope we'll be able to feature more of these stories in a future museum exhibition. I decided to select people who worked across the spectrum of departments, including machine repair, the sawmill, HR, and engineering. It's worth noting at this point, before you begin listening, what oral history is and what it is not, as it impacts how one listens to oral history, in my opinion. Oral history is not journalism. Oral history is not a podcast. But what is oral history then? It is a recording made specifically for the archival record. It is often recorded in someone's home, at their workplace, and less often in a studio. It can span from a monumental event that occurred, the details of a person's profession, passion, or expertise, or an entire life story of a person. In these oral histories tonight, you'll hear about the legacies of families at the mill, the kinds of jobs people did, and even some of the hazards of working at a factory. You'll hear about the joys they found in their work and some of the reflections on how the mill has impacted this community. Thank you so much for joining us. And after that lengthy introduction, I'm sure you're ready to hear the stories. I'll let each one run through and introduce the narrator by name before their section. So here we go. First, you'll hear from Tim Riando. He'll talk about white, black, and green liquor, whatever that is, stories about his father and tugs and ships that the mill used, and lastly, someone that they called Dr. Oz. Here's Tim.
How long did you work for the mill, and from what dates?
I've worked at the mill almost 40 years. I started in May of, 16th of 1980.
And until when? Oh, you're still there?
I'm still working there.
Oh, okay.
Present.
Okay. And did any of your family members?
My father worked there. Mm-hmm. He ran the tug.
Oh, okay.
And my older brother started at the mill and worked on the paper machine and transferred to a brand new mill, which is Wana. And my second brother ended up being a pulp mill foreman down here and retired out. Sister was the only trader. She went to Canada as a teacher.
And what was your job? What is your job? Has it been the same, or have you changed jobs?
I've changed jobs.
Okay. What did you start with?
I started off, I worked in the bag plant for one day, and the guy that told me to go down and interview found out I was working there and came and got me, and I went to work in the wood mill.
In the wood mill?
Yeah.
Oh, and what was your job there?
Well, I started at the bottom working, we call it farm wood, which is small logs that we were going to chip up.
Oh, okay.
And I was sawing them to the right length to get them in the mill. And I came from a saw shop, so that's why he kind of wanted me there in the first place.
What do you mean you came from a saw shop?
I worked out on a highway out here at Walt's Power Saw Chainsaw, and I worked on all the mill's chainsaws.
Have you been working with the wood mill?
I worked in the wood mill for 2 years until they shut it down. Uh-huh. And actually, when it was running, it was condemned, and they were paying a penalty to run it, and all the sawmills in the local area all switched to 36 inches. They wouldn't take anything bigger than that. And the logs that we were running in the wood mill were criminal because they were all old growth. They were 5 foot, 54 feet long. Uh-huh. And we had a chipper who would chip them up in less than 30 seconds.
So that's what you got?
Yeah.
So what happened to the chips
then? They went upstairs to be made into paper.
The pulp?
Yeah. Uh-huh. You want me to tell you how they make the pulp?
Sure. There?
So the chips would go up to what they call the screen room, which they would get them all the same size. And then they would go to what they call the monorail, which is a big bin on top of the digesters. They would dump them there and feed different species. In other words, if they wanted hemlock or they wanted fir or they wanted cedar, for strength on the paper machine, there was a batch mix that was pre-planned. Okay. And then the guys down below would load a digester, which is just a big pressure cooker. Mm-hmm. And they'd get as much in there as they can, and they would put white liquor in with it. And then they'd take it up to pressure, 80, 100 pounds, and hold it for like 2 hours. And then instead of letting the pressure down slowly, they just open the bottom of it, and it blows up, and it blows all that chips out, and it's called blowing a digester, and it breaks down all the wood into pulp. And the cellulose and stuff separates. And then they've got a bunch of drums that put water on it that wash the pulp to get that liquor that's in there that ate the wood up. Mm-hmm. It's called black liquor now because it's got tar in it, or pitch, and it's got the lignin and stuff that they don't want is in there, so they wash that out. And then that process, liquor actually goes into another pressure cooker that they get all the moisture out of it, mm-hmm. and we takes that black liquor to 70% solids. We put it in a boiler and burn it and get steam to make paper. And then it falls to the bottom as green liquor. Mm-hmm. And then the green liquor is sent to the lime kiln that adds lime to it and lets it settle out. And it turns white again so it can go right back upstairs and start all over. It's 95% efficient for steam. You know, we get free steam out of it by doing this. Mm-hmm. And it's funny is that process has been done ever since they started this mill. They got so supposedly more modern boilers and stuff, but when that mill was built, they did the same thing.
So it must be a pretty good system then.
Well, 95%.
Yeah, that's pretty good. You did that for 2 years, and then what?
2 years, and then they shut the wood mill down.
And why did they shut it down?
I really don't know. You know, we called more barkers that ran smaller logs, and I think they just decided to chip the logs off-site instead of doing it there. Mm-hmm. Probably more fit. Actually, somebody like Herman Brothers or something like that mm-hmm. took it over, okay. and it was cheaper, and they had better equipment and stuff. Mm-hmm. So they shut that down.
And they sent you where?
I went to work in the finishing room. And at that time, there was probably 60 people working in the finishing room. And got a rating in there. And over there, they had these cutters that would cut sheets into, you know, certain size. And we'd actually wrap them up for the customers that they might be putting a sheet in between something they're making to keep it from scuffing or we even made rolls and they were called counter rolls that the government bought that were in like their locker rooms. They could rip and stand on it while, you know, they were changing their socks or whatever from a shower or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and there was bigger ones for older stores that you know, you'd rip them under a calendar and actually wrap stuff up for people. Okay. They also made raisin tray there. Raisin tray was a special paper they made on a paper machine, and an engineer here in town, I think his name was Solvenson, actually designed this machine that would fold 12 sheets this way and then 12 sheets the other way, and then we put them in a bundle, and they were worth like $85 a piece, a lot of money. And what they are is they would put these in a tray and put them underneath the grapevines, and the grapes would fall off the deal, and they would just grab the top sheet, and they never touched the ground. Hmm. And that machine ran three shifts. There was like seven people worked on that machine. And it would run for 3 months and pay to run the mill for free the rest of the year. Made that much money.
And do they still do that?
No. When Crown sold out, they took that machine out of here and took it someplace else. After that year, I'm trying to think, 83 mm-hmm. or 84, yeah. They pretty much fired all hourly employees. And we were tested out at Fort Worden and rehired. For I think the 83, I got rehired, and it was like a day before Christmas on 83. You didn't know if you had a job or not, but anyway, got rehired.
And doing?
Well, they actually picked me for a bottom job on a paper machine. So that's where I've been till today.
So that's where you are still.
Yeah.
And jobs, but did it go, besides that, did it go relatively smooth?
There was probably 10% of the people didn't get rehired.
Mm, that's quite a few.
And there was some people that was a mistake on their names. that, you know, they were good employees and just got caught up in it. It didn't get rehired, so it was kind of, it was sad state there for a while, yeah.
Did you feel like wages overall, that's a large, you know, 40 years, a long time.
Yeah.
Overall, depending on the time frame, did you feel like the pay was comparable to what it took to raise a family?
I would say me working on a paper machine with my education, I don't think I could have made any more money than that. Mm-hmm. The only problem is when I first started on the paper machine, we were on the old Southern Swing, they call it, mm-hmm. 7 days in a row, and then you get 2 days off, and that was really hard on families. And if you're on swing shift in graveyard, you would see your kids for, you know, short amount of time. That was the only downfall I could say about the whole thing is the shift work. But now we're on 12-hour shifts. We work 2 days and 24 hours off, 2 nights and 4 days off. So I could, you know, and I know that schedule years in advance, so I can make plans. And
oh, okay. So that works pretty well.
Yeah, right? I wished I would have did that when we first started there. It would have been easier on my family.
Uh-huh.
That's probably the worst thing. The wages are good. It was hard on the family.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to make extra money, there was always an opportunity after 8 hours, you could work another eight. And we call that, you could use that for something special that you didn't account for or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it was available. I can remember in the 60s, that, you know, we had four doctors in town. There was Shell, Plute, and Dickerson, and Shire. Well, they pretty much all drove Cadillacs, and the four machine tenders were all known in this town as well. And everybody in town knew who they were, and they would drive the Cadillacs as well.
Oh, okay.
So it was, that's changed, but everybody knew who they were.
Can you tell me much about your dad running the tug?
So they had a small tug. It was the Diamond Z2. And the Diamond Z2 was steel. And they actually, when the mill built, they built the Diamond Z1 that was wood.
Uh-huh.
And she burnt. And she's down there. You can see it on low tide down there off of Old Fort Townsend. The hall.
Oh, okay.
And so they made sure that they built this one out of steel, and it had tremendous, you know, fire equipment on it for its age, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was it's quite a tug, but it was only 54 foot.
Mm-hmm.
But all he would do is shuttle stuff in the bay. And they would take scows that were, you know, already tied up and bring them in, switch them back and forth so they could unload them. Plus, there was logs down here at Chimicum Creek that Crown was bundling. And they would, part of their process would move them. Some of those were going to sawmills. Some of them were bundling to come into the wood mill. But that's what the tug did. But I could remember being a kid, phone would ring in the middle of the night, and they'd have one break loose or something that he'd have to go to work in the middle of the night. And I know he got the call on the Columbus Day storm in 63. And was told that all the barges were broke, and he said the Coast Guard can't get out, but he says, I'm going to go down and check the tug, and that's it. And he told me he had to crawl down the dock on his hands and knees to get to, even after, you know, with that breakwater down there.
Yeah.
He crawled down there, and he said the tug was setting up on top of the dock, about 50% of it. And that's the best he could do. So he just, you know, crawled back. And he said garbage cans were going down the street like bullets. And it was, I think it was 125 miles an hour or something like that. Yeah.
any other stories that he told you about being out there?
Yeah, he would have to go shuttle scows on Saturdays, you know. He might only have to move one. Mm-hmm. I would go to work with him, you know, 7, 8 years old, mm-hmm. and go down to the mill with him. And I don't know if the mill knew about it, but he would shuttle the barges and stuff. And I got to, you know, watch him work, and they were pretty good. They'd have big tugs bring him in, and I remember him going up against them to get the scows. And their cooks would always reach over and give me a piece of pie or something. Uh-huh. The cooks always wanted to feed somebody. He'd say, just let go of them. So they just released them out here in the bay, not hooked up to nothing, and he'd just take one and put it away and then catch up with the other one and put it away. It was no big deal.
Oh.
But, yeah, I got to see him do that.
Good memories.
Yeah, another memory, he told me that before they had scows, they used sailing ships down here for chips. And they were all starships, and I've talked to Pete Langley about it. And I had some of the hardware off and have given it to him, and he's, you know, gonna look and trying to recast some of it, because each one of the pieces has a star on it, and there's a star fleet. Well, there were 7 of them, and anyway, when they got done with them, they put them all on Glen Cove and they burnt them all right on the beach, except for one went to San Francisco to do a pirate movie, and then they sunk it for a fish habitat. But yeah, but the rest of them they burned on the beach. And then he said they went on the beach with a barge and picked up all the brass and stuff that was left over and loaded it in the barge, and that's how they dealt with it. During the war, you know, all the guys were gone. So the women were running a lot of the mill. And they would hire people by the day down there. And if you go in the office, they have these windows in the old clock alley.
Uh-huh.
Well, there's 6,000 soldiers here. So if the soldiers were on leave that day, they would hire them for the day to work. And then they'd pay them cash. And when they were done, you know, they got their spending money and they kept the place running. It's kind of unbelievable, but that's what they did. They would line up, and the bosses would say, I'll take him, and him, and uh-huh. and that's, they would do that every morning.
You said a lot of women were getting hired during that period of time. So were they doing all kinds of jobs, or
mostly they were in like the bag plant? There's probably a picture of 30 women in the finishing room. You think that, you know, they're coming down there to work, but they're all in dresses.
Out of all those different jobs, what was your favorite one?
I'd say my favorite job was working in the windmill. The deal is, the place was super dangerous. They only had certain type of people working in it. We were all nuts.
Oh.
And we enjoyed that. But the smell of that brand new wood in there every morning, mm-hmm. and the cedar, I just loved it. I think there was probably 10 people all that worked in there.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a machine in there called a water barker that would take the barks off the log.
Uh-huh.
And the glass in there was like a foot thick. It was bulletproof. Well, they had these curtains on both sides because they didn't want any light in there. They had light in there so they could see through this glass. Behind the operator was this big bench. And I and Frank Harry would try to go in. We want to watch this thing work. And the old guy in there would throw us out. He did not want us in there at all. I don't know. I don't think he wanted us to watch to see how we ran it or what. And we never seen the guy go to work. And we never seen him at lunchtime. And we never seen him go home. So we called him Dr. Oz, uh-huh. because he's behind the curtain.
Uh-huh.
And yet today, we don't know who this guy was.
Really?
I don't know.
Never knew?
No, worked there for 2 years, and I never seen him come to work, never seen him leave.
Hi, this is Shelley Levins. You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, and our program tonight, In Their Own Words, Millworkers Past and Present. Next, you'll hear from Rita Hubbard, who originally didn't want to work at the mill, but recently retired after nearly 25 years. She found herself supporting union workers and management in her various roles, and she shares her thoughts on newcomers to Port Townsend and changes through time.
And my husband was working at the mill at the time. And so he came and home and he said, you know, they're looking for a part-time person at the mill. And I said, I don't want to work at the mill. And he said, well, you should check it out. And I said, fine, you know, because I was only working part-time at Don's. So I checked it out, and sure enough, they had this part-time job of typing up all the notes from all the meetings, and they had a lot of meetings. And so I just had these huge pieces of paper with all of these notes that people wanted me to type up. And back then, everybody was smoking at their desks. Remember that? Hated that. And then after 24 and a half years, I retired. So yeah, it was a great place to work. The thing that I miss the most, of course, is the people. People are the ones that, you know, are the heartbeat of that mill, and especially the union workers that are there, just awesome, awesome people. I've worked with some good managers and some good CEOs, you know, in the past, and it's just been a really good time. Glad to be gone, though.
Yeah. What was your favorite job of all those things?
I think customer service, when we first started that, was my favorite at that time, because I had a lot of we had a lot of customers, and I got to talk to a lot of different people. But then when I moved into the admin assistant position, that was good. And because I had transitioned from, like, you know, one job to another, all the union workers that I worked with knew me and trusted me. And so they felt they could come in and talk to me, and, you know, be able to, if they didn't feel like they could talk to the manager or the president, they could talk to me, and they knew that I would relay, you know, whatever concerns that anybody had. Because I felt like I was a very fair person, and so did they. They thought that I was a really fair person. So those are the guys that I miss the most, the ones that, you know, I worked with every day. And I was working with safety, health and safety as well. And so I did a lot of work with that, with, you know, injuries and working with the employees when they would be injured and that kind of stuff.
So what does that mean?
If they got injured at the mill, then you would have to file a labor and industries report.
And word out there bandaging their arms.
Oh, no. Okay. No, but we did have an emergency response team that would do, you know, immediate. But no, I would just, sometimes I would accompany to the hospital with them to the emergency room. And most recently, our manager of the machine shop cut his thumb, almost tried to cut it off, actually. And so I got him up to the emergency room and sat with him until his wife got there. And, you know, things like that. And, you know, that was just that kind of support that I like to give people.
Well, you have a kind of a multi-generational family at the mill, right? Does anybody else from your family work there?
Well,
the only one?
I moved to Port Townsend in 1986, uh-huh. and then I met my husband in 1990, mm-hmm. And so his kids, except for Terry, his three boys all worked at the mill. Okay. His youngest, Russell, only worked there for a short time, and then he moved to Alaska. Jeff still works there. He's in the recycle plant, and Lloyd is a millwright in the plant. And so my family, no, yeah. my blood family doesn't mm-hmm. work there. But there are a lot of families at the mill. Some of them, they maybe skipped a generation, but then they're back again. The thing that I love about the mill is that kids that can't or don't want to go to college can go right into the mill right after high school and get a good wage, a good paying job. And they can learn a whole lot there. You know, if they apply themselves, they can become millwrights, or they can become, you know, superintendents. They can become whatever in the mill. They can move up and do that kind of stuff. And they are good paying jobs. I mean, I think they go into it starting at like $15 an hour or something, and that's just during the probation period. And then it just jumps from there. So it's a good wage plus benefits. You know, they've got vacation and sick and 401k. I mean, You know, they've got lots of the retirement. They've got lots of options at the mill, and that affords them that. And so I'm a big proponent of kids being able to learn trades if they can't or don't want to go to college. And we need trades. We need the plumbers and the electricians and, you know, those guys, because everybody needs plumbing. Everybody needs electricity, you know. Not everybody needs to have an MBA. You have to have the recycling. You have to. You know, it's just for sustainability, for the economy, for the world. You have to do this recycling. And so every time anything happens, you know, oh, the mill's going to close. Well, they've been saying that since 1928 when it opened. So it's I see it being around forever. I mean, the investors that are there now are very committed, and they just bought two more mills in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and so they're very committed to keeping this mill. And you know, the fact is, they're pumping money into it, so they're wanting it to succeed. So they're trying to put the people in place that are going to help that happen.
What about community relations? I mean, there's always, especially as the town has changed over the years, there's been people who, you know, are upset by the mill.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you, can you talk about that?
Yeah, because I don't work there anymore. I can talk about it personally.
Yeah.
When I was working there, I had to be more politically correct. You know, my dad was a factory worker, and he worked in a brass foundry. I came from a town, Evansville, Indiana, that was an industrial city. So, you know, I had no problem with that at all. You know, one case in point, one of our HR managers was talking to someone who was complaining about the smell, and they had just moved here, and their real estate person told them that the smell did not reach them, so that they didn't have to worry about it. And he paused and he said, well, they lied. Because, you know, depending on which way the wind is blowing, you're going to smell it. Now, it is 1,000% better now than it was when I moved here in 1990. I moved here, 86. When I moved here, it was, you know, a lot more odoriferous. But now, I mean, I never even smell it. And, you know, and for some people who accept that the mill is here, they just accept it as, you know, one of the things that happens in certain days. It's like that. And so people shouldn't complain about the mill, because it's providing the economy for the city. It's providing jobs, it's providing, you know, a way of life for people that live here, and, you know, deal with it.
What would the politically correct statement be?
You know, sorry, we're doing everything we can to keep and they do, even still, right now, they're dredging the pond. The smell is coming from the pond, okay? So they're dredging the pond, and it takes millions of dollars to update that pond. And so they do it as often as they can. Sorry, but I was in Safeway one time, and I was buying a bunch of supplies for a picnic, you know, barbecue that we were having at the mill. This guy was in front of me, and he goes, wow. And I said, yeah, I said, it's a barbecue for the mill. And Jennifer, whose father worked at the mill for a long time, Mike Miller's daughter, was checking me out. And he said, well, let me ask you this. He says, is there anything they can do about that smell? And I looked at him and I said, how long have you lived here? And he went, good point. And Jennifer looked at him. She said, do not say anything bad about our mill. He says, it keeps my job going here. So I like that mill. And he goes, okay. He said, I'll deal with it. So, you know, it's just have to know that, you know, there is history here, and these people value that history. And, you know, yeah, there's changes. Who wanted two roundabouts, you know, a quarter of a mile from each other? Nobody. But, you know, change happens.
Hi, thanks for joining us. This is Shelley Levins, and you're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM. Our program tonight, In Their Own Words, Mill Workers Past and Present. Coming up, you'll hear from Jim Little, who left the mill in 2017 after 34 years and followed in his father's footsteps as a pipe fitter. He became union president and enjoyed his views of Mount Rainier from the pipe shop.
Are you the only person in your family that worked at the mill?
No, my dad worked there for many years and had a brother and a sister that actually worked there too. So.
And what were their names?
There was Kay and Glenn.
What was your dad's name?
George Little.
George?
Yeah.
And when did your dad start working there?
He came here during World War II.
Oh, okay.
And then he was in the Coast Guard, Coast Watch, whatever that was. And then moved, got married, moved back here, liked it really well, and worked to the mill. It was in the 50s, the early, late 50s, I believe. And he was a pipe fitter down there, and that's what I was down at the mill, too, as a pipe fitter welder.
When were you hired? When did you start?
I started there in 1984 when the Germans took it over. So. Oh.
So did you keep the same job through the whole time?
No, I worked on the paper machines.
So you started out?
Yeah, I started out on the paper machines. Uh-huh. And then I became a insulator, painter, out of the yard, I guess you would call it. Uh-huh. The bull gang, the old time is what they used to call it. But.
Is the bull gang with...
Well, it was just a group of people that would go out and do all sorts of stuff around the mill, clean up, fix a drain pipe, something just, they were, usually did all the grunt jobs, did that for a little while. And then, but like I say, I was an insulator and actually an asbestos worker too. I was, we would patch and repair, remove, and, a little bit, not much, when they usually have a big company coming in. And then about in 1992, I got into the pipe fitter crew, and I was then I became a journeyman pipe fitter through the apprentice program down there.
So they had their own apprentice?
Yeah, they had it at one time. It was really, really pretty good, too, so, but they let it go.
And then how long did you work there?
Well, I worked there from 1984 until 2017. That was 34 years.
Back up to the paper machine. What does that mean? You worked with the paper machine. What is the job?
Well, the mill has two paper machines, actually. Mm-hmm. They have number one paper machine, number two. Mm-hmm. And they make pulp on number one. And number two, they made we made many grades of paper, of brown paper. Brown paper bags, mm-hmm. many, many different grades, which they don't do now, but they make just a few grades now. But that was working on the paper machines. It was, you're actually getting the process at the end. You're making the rolls of paper. So
that involves bringing the pulp in and...
We called it back in because that was where the steam was made. And then they came to the midsection, which was the pulp mill, and that's where they made the pulp, which came to the paper machines to make paper and pulp, because number one makes just pulp and number two makes paper on it. So.
So you're standing there at your job, and mm-hmm. what do you have to do to create?
Well, we were watching the machine make these humongous reels of paper.
Okay.
Which the reels would build up to a certain size, and we would have to, well, when I worked on there, you actually had to get in there and cut a tail of the process, the paper making process, which is this paper, this 240 inch wide sheet of paper that's going by you at 2,000 feet a minute, and this thing is, flying through, and you'd get up there with a knife and cut it, and they would, it was, now it's all automated now. You don't have to do that.
And, good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was pretty wild. It was pretty wild. But then it goes and you take that reel and put it on the winder. It would go through a series of, strapping it, labeling it, and then that was what you were always looking for the day, is that it was brown and round and send it down, and you didn't have to stop and clean up a mess then when the paper machine blows up in front of your face, not blow up, but we always called it a blow up because it just, you know, if the paper broke, you can just imagine what happens when, you know, it's like when you, you know, you're pulling out a roll of paper and it just goes, you know, and all over the place. But then in turn, then you take that and it all goes to a repulper and it all gets used up again. So, yeah, so that's one thing about the, when you did have a break on the paper machine, you would have places where there was what they called a beater or a repulper, and it would repulp it back up and run it through the system again.
Nothing was wasted.
No, the majority of it wasn't wasted unless it got into the drain, but usually it didn't. But then, you know, of course, now with the OCC, the old corrugated cardboard that they're repulping, that was a whole, you know, another part of the mill that I never worked in that part. But
And then when you got into the pipe printer journeyman, when you became the apprentice, tell me about that.
Well, that was something I always wanted to do because my dad was, that's what he was down there with a pipe fitter. Of course, I not only had half the tools already because my dad had them, but it was getting off the shift work and going to day work. I always was, you know, working with my hands. I knew if I was going to stay at the mill, I was going to get a day job because I couldn't work shift work. I mean, they went to the 12-hour shifts and I just wasn't going to work. I was starting a family then too, so I really wanted to work day shift, and I kept trying, but it was a process. You had to apply for the job and apprentice job, and then I finally got it after, you know, I tried the whole time I was there I worked in the production for 6 years and then got into the maintenance part of it, so.
Tell me what it was like when you went to job as work as a pipe fitter.
I was real fortunate. I got to work on the paper machines. I enjoyed the paper machine area. I worked with Dwayne Russell. He was the head pipe fitter on the paper machines. I got to learn my apprenticeship with Dwayne Russell. That was a real treat because we would start out our day. We would sometimes go up and talk to the paper machine foreman, find out what was broken, you know, find out there was something that we could do, you know, to make the process keep going, or, you know, or then we would get ready for shutdowns, times when they turn the machine off, and then we throw everybody we had at it to, you know, fix a crack in a pipe, fix a drain in the floor, you know, sometimes we had to go fish a toilet, you know, it was just one of those kind of things, you know, we had all sorts of pipe fitting, you know, when it came to anything pipe in the paper machine, we would work on it. So we would have places around the mill where we would stash stuff, you know, just so we didn't have to go, you know, we always had, you know, three buckets of tools where you were out on a job because you might, you know, you might be working on the piping for a pump. And then all of a sudden something breaks down and boom, you zoom off to another job to get it done and then come back to that. And I mean, it was a maintenance person. It was our job to keep our area when it came to pipes and that kind of stuff, to keep it running, so. Because everything ran in, you know, mostly everything was all in pipes, stainless steel or steel pipes, so. I'm kind of one of the craziest guys. I really liked my job down there. You know, I mean, we had our differences with the management. I was union president for years down there, but still had to, you know, it was our job to do what we had to do. And it was actually, you know, every once in a while you had a bad day, but you know, that was.
Oh,
the favorite part was just getting something done and getting it, having the process keep going. And a lot of the people you worked with down there were really great because you spent so much time with them. I was most of the time working by myself. There was on the paper machine. Once Dwayne left, I was pretty much kind of taking care of the area by myself, and I'd have people come in and help me when we had shutdowns. Mm-hmm. But actually, when it came to working there, it was the people. A lot of, you know, the best thing was the people working around. I mean, it was not only the people, you know, in the pipe crew, but there was people. You know, in the warehouse where you went every day to get your parts and, you know, or order parts or whatever, you know, and then the, you know, a lot of the bosses, I mean, it's, you know, we all, you knew what you had to do, so you just had to keep the bosses happy, and then, you know, you knew the machine was running good, so. Because, I mean, production, I mean, it, you had to make production, and that was where you're making money and kept the place running, so. Because, I mean, it was a big part of my life, you know. It supported my family for years and years. It, you know, it made some of my family frustrated when they didn't get hired back. But, you know, that's how it works. And then I remember, because I wasn't in the union at the first, I went, I don't need to do that. But I knew the importance of it later, you know, after I finally got there and I finally realized that, you know, you're in a workforce that needs protection, you know, any way you can, and if the mill isn't going to do it, the union should, you know, so that's why I stayed there. We had numerous unions came and went, you know, we were absorbed into something, went from a mainly paper industry union to, you know, the United Steelworkers, which is, you know, wow, they cover everything now, you know, they're kind of the bigger union in the world. But in fact, we were part of the AWPPW, which is now still negotiating, you know, the opening of the plant up in Port Angeles.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because they're, yeah. So.
Did you tell me how long your dad?
Well, my dad, he retired. It was really sad. He must have worked there 25 years because he had a pretty good retirement when he got out of there, but he retired and 3 months later died. So. Oh.
The general pay range pretty comparable to other?
There were some areas that were lower than other places. Mm-hmm. You know, it was something that was negotiated, you know, and one of the things we did negotiate were more raises than we did retirement.
Oh, okay.
And that was kind of one of the thing. And then medical, just trying to keep the medical. I mean, that's what I found out being retired now, that medical, we should have pushed to keep as much medical as we could. But
you feel, while you were working at the mill, that it was enough to raise your family? And
yeah, I think there was. I think it was. I mean, I could go over a million different ways and not come up with an answer of how we should have gotten more, or always should have gotten more, you know. I mean, we were working, doing our job, we should have been paid more, you know, but I was finding out that we put our son through college, and I mean, the mill's here, it's been here, it's helped me throughout my years. There's a lot of people in this town that have, we're born and raised with that mill. I never wanted to work at that mill when I first went into the workforce. I mean, you got to make the best of what you got. And if you're so mad at working at a place, how could you even work there? You know, I mean, demon Christmas. I had more things. I'm a Boy Scout leader. We go out, you know, camping, and we, you know, do all sorts of canoeing and kayaking, and those are more important things that they need to do. And I don't have to have a big chip on my shoulder when I'm working.
So. One of the things that I like that you said was that it was the people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was definitely the people that worked there. Yeah. You always had to kind of make it fun, you know. There was definitely days where you come in and it was just, you know, I mean, I worked on the paper machine. It was really hot up there all the time. And in the middle of winter, you know, it was still 140 degrees, you know. But, you had to get it done. There was things you had to do. And, you know, you walk away from it, go outside and walk out onto the dock and, you know, look at Mount Rainier. And we had a beautiful view at the pipe shop. We were on the outside of the mill. And we had a beautiful view of Mount Rainier down. We'd look out our door, and, I mean, Mount Rainier was just right there, you know, and we'd look over this way, and we could almost see Mount Faker, but, you know.
Hi, this is Shelley Levins. You're listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM. Our program tonight, In Their Own Words, Mill Workers Past and Present, we're going to wrap up with Yvonne Starkey, who was the first female mechanical engineer hired in 1978. Here's Yvonne.
Tell me what, as your first job, mm-hmm. as a mechanical engineer, what did that look like when you came into work? What were you doing?
I think my very first project was installing a little catwalk to make it easier for folks to get access to some equipment. And I did some pump installations, some small other small systems of relocating of a molten sulfur plant. Really, what one of the very first things is we had the strike of 1978. Oh, and so in August of 78, I helped run the mill. And then when they decided, Crown Zellerbach decided to really operate some of the other mills, quite a few of us went to the Port Angeles mill and operated the Port Angeles mill and actually produced paper. And my role up there was in the back end or the steam plant. And so I got to run boilers and do things that, you know, most engineers at the beginning of their career would never get to do. And so that was really quite a learning experience and fun, really. They did a different kind of shift work back then. They did like 5 days of 8 hour day shifts, 5 days of 8 hour swing shift, 5 days of 8 hour graveyards. And it was really tough to adapt, tough to figure out when you're supposed to sleep and when you aren't supposed to sleep. You know, they have probably 3 million, I can't remember the exact numbers these days, maybe $3 million worth of spare parts down there. Mm. And keeping track of where everything is, what it's associated to. We had implemented two different computer programs during my tenure there. And so that was, it's always fun to have that kind of a project and that kind of learning that goes on and figuring out what you can do to make it easier for people to find parts in the middle of the night that they need. Mm-hmm. And really trying to get the system to be as robust as possible. Plus, keeping an eye on the bottom line and making sure that we aren't spending so much money on spare parts, because that's just kind of money that's just sitting there, you know. So really being cognizant of the business aspects of that function and in purchasing, you know, the business aspects are a big deal because you're establishing contracts for different commodities or chemicals and that sort of thing as well. I really, really found the enjoyment and the reward in the latter part of my career, being a part of the management of the mill, you know, really feeling like I could contribute to make the mill profitable. And, you know, being more in control of my own piece in that is very rewarding.
Did it feel like your engineering background was put to good use?
Towards the end of my career, I was involved with the water system, you know, that's really owned by the city of Port Townsend. And, you know, some of the big projects that happened on the water line, it was while I was on that watch. Being a part of the management of the projects, the major projects that happened on the water line, like the city, some work that was done at City Lake primarily comes to mind. It was a huge project where basically the normal outlet for the lake had to be redone, and some piping that was in a big tunnel had to be redone because it was, the piping was decaying. And so it was a big deal to run the mill and run the city so that it was, we were never without water. And to get that project done so that, you know, it had to be dry, it had to be. And so at the city and their contractor, they really did a magnificent job on that, making sure that that happened. But, you know, if the water line breaks anywhere upstream of City Lake, there is no cushion. The city has a cushion because they have reservoirs. Mm-hmm. They have reservoirs, but... Oh, I said that wrong. If it breaks, the water line breaks downstream of City Lake, there is no recourse for the mill but to potentially shut down and get those fixed. And that happened a couple of times on my watch. And you know, that's, it's never a good feeling to be responsible for taking the mill down. Yes. Yeah. At all. That is not a good feeling. And so always the pressure to get that fixed and going right away.
So does the mill have... crews that went out and worked on it?
Or? Well, the mill has a 3-man waterline crew. They really manage the waterline for the city, mill does. And like I said, I don't know how that's going to change after March 2020. Mm-hmm. And so at least at, and some of the personnel on the water line has changed since I've left. So we had our own weld of that 3-man crew. A couple of them were really good welders, and they took care of, they took care of those kinds of repair requirements. It was amazing how a lifetime could go past and you just didn't even realize it. I think that's what I just take away at the end, looking back, go, it was, never anything I expected. I expected to be part of Crown Zellerbach, to be at this mill for 5 or 6 years, transfer to another mill for 5 or 6, you know, and move my way around the industry. With Crown Zellerbach going kaput and Port Townsend Paper Corporation coming to fruition in 1984, it just kind of changed that whole thing. And well, and Niles establishing his business, which you don't exactly pick it up and move it. I just ended up staying here, and it just was like, you know, how those years passed. I have no idea how they passed. They did. I was the first engineer that was, female engineer that was hired at Port Townsend Paper.
That's pretty significant.
And I still run into the wife of the fellow who hired me, and he passed away a number of years ago. And she said, I always will remember Lowell being so proud that he hired you. I don't remember that, but that's Lillian's memory. Because there's kind of a rare deal back in the day to have female mechanical engineers out in the world. But so yeah, I was the first. Then Eveline, I don't think we've ever had another mechanical engineer who is a gal, but other engineers have come along. So that was kind of fun to say I was the first. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty significant.
Yeah. Anyway.
And did when you went to work as being the first, did you have support of the people you were working with?
Oh, the people I was, like the other engineers were terrific, I thought. And, you know, a couple of them really mentored me and took me under their wings.
Thank you for joining us for, in their own words, Mill Workers Past and Present, brought to you by the Jefferson County Historical Society. Thanks again to KPTZ 91.9 FM for hosting this program. Don't forget to visit our website for all the program recordings in this series. And we'll see you at the Jefferson Museum soon.